In our studies tonight in the book of Numbers, last week being an introduction to Numbers, not to Leviticus, as I understand I mistakenly said. Numbers, we deal with the first two chapters, and I'm sure you'll bear with me if I guide you through the census that's contained within the first chapter by jumping from section to section rather than read through the whole list of names. You can do that for yourself at home and follow down the significance of these names, but the structure is clearer, I think, if I do that with you tonight. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, reading from the Revised Standard Version. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second month in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel, by families, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, all in Israel who are able to go forth to war. You and Aaron shall number them company by company. And there shall be with you a man from each tribe, each man being the head of the house of his fathers. And these are the names of the men who shall attend you. From Reuben, and then from Simeon, verse 6. From Judah, from Issachar, verses 7 and 8. From Zebulun, verse 9, from the sons of Joseph, from Ephraim in verse 10, from Manasseh also in verse 10, from Benjamin in verse 11, from Dan in verse 12, from Asher verse 13, from Gad verse 14, and from Naphtali in verse 15. Of course, that covers all 12 tribes. These then, verse 16, were the ones chosen from the congregation, the leaders of their ancestral tribes, the heads of the clans of Israel. Moses and Aaron took these men who have been named, and on the first day of the second month they assembled the whole congregation together, who registered themselves by families, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, head by head, as the Lord commanded Moses. So he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. Now we begin to take some jumps over these verses. The people of Reuben, verse 20, numbered 46,500, verse 21. The people of Simeon, verse 22, numbered 59,300, verse 23. The people of Gad, verse 24, numbered 45,650, verse 25. The people of Judah, 26, numbered 74,600, verse 27. Verse 28, the people of Issachar, numbered 54,400, verse 29. Of the people of Zebulun, verse 30, the number 57,400. Of the people of Joseph, verse 32, the number of the tribe of Ephraim, of course they go together, was 40,500. Of the people of Manasseh, 32,200, verse 35. Of the people of Benjamin, 35,400, verse 38. Of the people of Dan, 62,700. Verse 40, of the people of Asher, 41,500. Of the people of Naphtali, verse 42, 53,400. Verse 44, these are those who were numbered, whom Moses and Aaron numbered with the help of the leaders of Israel, 12 men, each representing his father's house. So the whole number of the people of Israel by their father's houses, from 20 years old and upward, every man able to go forth to war in Israel, their whole number was 603,550. And from there, of course, we took our nominal figure of about 2 million in the nation last Sunday evening. Verse 47, but the Levites were not numbered by their ancestral tribe along with them. For the Lord had said to Moses, only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, and you shall not take a census of them among the people of Israel, but appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They are to carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall tend it, and shall encamp around the tabernacle. There's the only tribe that had no ensign, you see. When the tabernacle is set out, the Levites shall take it down. When the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. And if anyone else comes near, he shall be put to death. The people of Israel shall pitch their tents by their companies, every man by his own camp, every man by his own standard. But the Levites shall encamp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath upon the congregation of the people of Israel. And the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony. Thus did the people of Israel. They did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, the people of Israel shall encamp each by his own standard with the ensigns of their fathers' houses. They shall encamp facing the tent of meeting on every side. Now, there are four sides, of course, east and west, south and north. Those who encamped to the east were Judah, verse 3, and the two accompanying tribes of Issachar and Zebulun. And that made up the vastly largest single force. Then to verse 10, on the south side, and that of course puts it out on one of the wings of travel, on the south side shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben, so it's Reuben plus 2, the tribe of Simeon, and the tribe of Gad. Then, verse 17, the tent of meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps. As they encamp, so shall they set out, each in position, standard by standard. That's just to let you know that the tabernacle travelled in the centre of the company. Thirdly, verse 18, on the west side, Ephraim plus two tribes, Manasseh and Benjamin. And finally, verse 25, on the north side, Dan and the remaining two tribes, Asher and Naphtali. Then at verse 32, these are the people of Israel as numbered by their fathers' houses, all in camps, who were numbered by their companies. They were 603,550. But the Levites were not numbered among the people of Israel, as the Lord commanded Moses. Amen. And may God add both understanding and blessing to this reading of his word. Now, there are people who find the history of the Old Testament very confusing, and I have a great deal of sympathy with them. Let me tell you that it really is quite easy to understand the history of the Old Testament at this stage of things. Put it like this. The Old Testament runs straight through from Exodus chapter 19 to Numbers chapter 10 with the people of Israel in one place. The people of Israel are at Mount Sinai, and they are there until they set off through the desert to arrive at last on the doorstep of the land of Canaan for the first time. Now, the first 10 chapters or so of the book of Numbers can be easily understood, at least in this sense, that this is all preparation for the journey. At chapter 10, verse 10, you find the people arriving at Sinai, but here they are being prepared for the journey. There are actually three main parts to the book of Numbers, and they are set in three distinct venues, three different places. The second of them takes place in the wilderness, chapter 10 at verse 11 through to chapter 21. And then finally the book ends on what we call the doorstep of Canaan, on the plains of Moab, from chapter 22 to the end. So here we are with the people of God being prepared. Now, our chapters this evening, chapters 1 and 2, are concerned with the first numbering, or the first census of the people. Then they are concerned with the results of that census. There's a section dealing particularly with the Levites, as you saw. And the last concern is with the order of the people. Their order in camp, their order in travel, and their order for battle. Perhaps it's worth saying to you that the title that we give the book of Numbers, is actually an English translation from the old Latin translation of the Old Testament, what we call the Septuagint. Now that is alright, I suppose, because it picks up these first two chapters and what happens later on for the second time in chapter 26, that is the taking of the census, and it uses the word from the Latin translation to give a title to the book. However, the traditional title of this book to the Hebrew is taken from the fourth word of the book itself, the word which gives us in the wilderness. And this being, for the Hebrew mind, the fourth book of the five books of Moses, it's an apt title. But it's also an apt title because in the wilderness tells us what the book is about. The numbering only happens on these two separate occasions. So there's a better title, if you like, than the title, the Book of Numbers. In the wilderness. This is what the Book of Numbers is about. It is an account of the experiences of God's people as He prepared them for their destiny. Chapter 1, then, is concerned with the first census. Now the opening verse opens up a great deal for us. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting. They're very important words. The Lord spoke. That's a tremendous opening to a book. It's like the opening in the New Testament to the book of Hebrews. In many and in various ways God has spoken. But in these last days He has spoken to us by a Son. The Lord spoke. We are not dealing with a God of silence. And we are not creatures of a God who is silent or who falls silent. Now that may sound very obvious to you, but it's a tremendous truth. Our God is not a silent God. He is a God who speaks to His people, who makes Himself known not only in His dealings with them, but particularly He makes Himself known as He speaks with them. In a previous century, we would have described this as a God who makes Himself known in propositional truth. But whether you use that phrase or not matters not a whit, as long as you get hold of this tremendous truth. Your God is a God who speaks with His people. He does not fall silent unless His people are refusing to hear. God did not issue His laws at Sinai and then leave the people of Israel to get on with it, having no more to say to them. And God is not like that now. He has spoken fully and finally in His Son. His last word is in His Son as far as the Scriptures are concerned. That's complete. But God continues to speak in and through His Word and in and through the work of His Holy Spirit. Personally and collectively, we are spoken to by a God and Father who does not fall silent unless we are not listening. God does not issue commands and then leave us to get on with it as best we may. He speaks. Now here is another key to open up the book of Numbers, a key that also will unlock much of the Old Testament for you. That is, as God speaks here, This is not a book, firstly, about Israel. And as God speaks here, it's not firstly a book either about Israel's experiences of God or God's actions with His people. It is a book about God Himself. It's important that you get hold of that. That the Old Testament speaks about the nature of God. It speaks firstly about God Himself, revealed in and revealed through all His dealings with His people. And I would put it to you that the history of the Church of Jesus Christ is the same history. That the story of the congregation here in the West Kirk is the same story. That the unfolding story of your life as a Christian is the same story. That is, it is not firstly about your experiences or our experiences. It is about God Himself. It is about knowing God, about being right with God, being put right with God, about loving God. And while we could record the events of our lives individually and our life together and of God's dealings with His church as a series of events, they are not firstly just a series of events, but they are a record of what God is like as He shows Himself in action. It's God first, and the book of Numbers, like the whole of the Bible, brings us to God first, and then speaks to us about ourselves, our need, and speaks to us in guidance and encouragement and correction and in mercy. The Lord spoke. The Lord spoke to Moses. The two major themes of these opening chapters of Numbers are these: order and place. Now, order in the sense of God's nature being revealed in His love, of a pattern that shows His nature. And place in the sense that every child of God has a place in God's purposes. God the Lord spoke to Moses. Moses had a place within God's order of things, a particular and a unique place. Moses was the mediator of a covenant, which for all that it was the covenant of the law, is yet the covenant of mercy. Moses therefore stands in the Bible as he stood through his own life and as he stood throughout the Old Testament dispensation. Moses still stands in the Bible right into the New Testament as a foreshadowing of the one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, as Paul puts it in 1 Timothy. The Lord spoke to Moses. Moses has a place within the order of things in God's will and purpose. God does choose and set aside individuals. God continues to choose and set aside groups of people within His whole people. Within all the people He has called out and set aside to be His church. Now this is not favoritism. Favoritism is a human sin, is it not? It's not favoritism. And it's nothing to do with human authority or human greatness or giftedness. It's not to do with people who are outstanding in their abilities. But God sets aside individuals and groups of people and He humbles them as He does so. And sometimes being set aside by God is an isolating experience, a costly experience. It was for Moses. And it is for many a Christian a costly thing to be called by God to a particular place and a particular function. And yet I tell you, I believe every Christian is called to a particular place and function. More of that in a moment. More of that when we come, for example, to look at the Levites and their very special place. But for now, will you just note this as we go past? But this is the way God works, and this is the way God is working. However unpopular that thought might be in some circles today, God continues to call people and call them to a particular place and a particular function. God spoke to Moses as God would speak through Moses, and as God would fully and finally give his word in his Son. Do you see? God continues to set people aside, individuals and groups of people set aside in a particular place and in the particular order of his will to do a particular piece of service. The Lord spoke to Moses, it goes on, in the tent of meeting. Now let me say to you very clearly that God does not need a tent of meeting. He never did. That God does not need particular buildings, and yet there is something very important for us to learn here about God himself. And it is that he chooses to make his glory dwell amongst his people where he pleases. That he makes himself known in particular places. And I believe, of course I believe, I'm sure you do too, that God makes himself known as his people gather together in worship. Now you have to be very careful about this, of course. In Christ, the whole of the tabernacle system, the temple system, the sacrificial system of worship is finished and over. Not because it was a failure, but because he, Christ, fulfilled it all. And God must now be worshipped in spirit and in truth, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem, as he said to the woman in Samaria. But remember the two themes of this opening chapter, order and place. You see, it's not that God needs a building in which to be worshipped. It's not that that is primary here at all. It's that God has a place for each of us. And in that place, God will speak to us in a particular way. In that place where he wishes us to be, to worship and to serve him, God speaks to us. And I believe, don't you also, that not to be in your place is to be disobedient to God. Now I would never advocate, I hope you would never believe it of me, worshipping a building or the fabric of a building. Of course not. But we are talking more about a place in terms of a place where God's people are together. And a place where God has a particular function for his people. If that's still a bit cloudy to you, I'm sure you'll understand more as we go on. The question for just now is, how can we hear what the Lord has to say to us if we are not in the place where he wants us to be? If we are not where God is speaking to his people as they gather together to serve him? Let me put it as simply as I can. We are called to be the church of Jesus Christ. But part of that being the church is being together in worship and for service on the Lord's Day and on other days when God's people gather together. Now I can say this thus far in the early days of my ministry amongst you. I can say this without being suspected of pointing fingers. I'm sure there are people who should be here amongst us tonight. I'm not just simply saying that they should be in this building. I'm saying that they should be with us. That God has a place for them to be here in worship and for service. Now how are they going to hear what God is saying to us as a people of his calling if they are not amongst us in worship? The Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting. The Lord still speaks to his people in the place of their meeting. Not because it's a particular place, but because they meet in his name. And what is the command? Moses, take a census. It took them 19 days to take the census. Well, that's no surprise. But it was a task which, however long it took, could only be undertaken if God commanded it. You see, when we take a census, it's for purposes of taxation or for purposes of making assessments for the future. Now, that was nothing to do with the census here. If any Israelite ever counted the people of Israel in order to find out how strong they were or how rich they were, that was a sin. In 1 Chronicles chapter 21, it says that David numbered the people of God and he brought judgment upon the nation by doing it. But it also says there that it was Satan who incited David to number the people of God. This numbering, this taking of a census could only be undertaken by God's command and for God's purposes. And this taking of a census was not to allow Moses and Aaron and the leaders of the people to measure the strength of the people as an army. Because their strength, as ours, was not in numbers at all. Their strength was not in their organization. Their strength was not in the efficiency of their army or their chain of command. Their strength was in the Lord's presence in the midst of his people, as ours is. No, this census was to set the nation in order and to set each tribe in its place and each family in its place within the tribe and each individual within each family finding his particular place in the marching order. Every Israelite had a unique place, one place, in this marching army. It's tremendous. Do you see what I'm saying about a place for each of us? Our God is a God of order. He created all things out of nothing, whatever that is. And he made a world of order. And is it not true that the beauty of this creation is in its order? It's the order of it all that speaks to us of something wonderful and ineffable and tremendous. God's nature is seen in his order. God is a God of order and meaning. That's what this is about. The ordering of God's people, a place for each person within God's people. And that has two purposes as far as their journey is concerned. The one purpose is for pilgrimage, and the second purpose is for battle. We'll come to that again in a moment. But you see that there is the pattern beginning to emerge in this book of Numbers. Now there are all sorts of complicated questions when you start to break this chapter up into groups and tribes and gatherings of tribes. There are all sorts of complications when you start to get an idea of this 603,500 fighting men and all their families. But the significance of it all has to do with the order of things. You see, if you set the way God is putting his people in order here with the blessings that God promised to his people in Genesis chapter 49 when old Jacob lay dying, then you begin to see the significance. And one significant thing that comes out quite soon is the unequal strength of the tribes. Now take just one tribe. Take Reuben as an example. Reuben was the firstborn and should have been the tribe of preeminence in Israel. And yet, if you look at the numbers of Reuben, they are well down, 46,500 approximately. Now, what is said in Genesis concerning Reuben? Unstable as water, you shall not excel. This is a reference, of course, to the birthright of the sons of Joseph, because Reuben sinned against his father. No king came from the tribe of Reuben. No judge arose from the tribe of Reuben. No prophet came from Reuben through all its history. First Chronicles says this, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, because he was the firstborn, but he polluted his father's couch. And because he did this, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph. You see, there is an unequal strength amongst the tribes, because it is a consequence of their obedience and disobedience before God. Moses came from the tribe of Levi, didn't he? Joshua came from the tribe of Ephraim. Caleb, the faithful one, came from Judah. Samuel came from Ephraim again. David from the tribe of Judah, and so on. The people of God had to realize that they did not live to themselves, that their actions had a consequence for generations yet to come. And it's a solemn lesson we have to learn, that our actions have consequences for those who come after us. It's obviously true that our actions have consequences on the lives of our children. And given God's grace and mercy, given God's overarching readiness to redeem and take brands from the burning, it is still true that parents' disobedience and parents' compromise in Christian things bears fruit in their children's lives and can bear a bitter fruit even in their grandchildren. Of course, so can the obedience and the commitment to Christ of parents bear beautiful fruit in the lives of children and grandchildren. And we have to make great allowances, of course, for the fact that even little ones who've been brought up in gentleness and firmness and in the faith can turn away from the living God, and that the living God can bring the children of parents who have no commitment themselves to himself in grace. But isn't it still true that parents who are bored with the gospel, or who have backslidden from Christ, can see a bitter fruit very often in the lives of their own children? We don't live to ourselves. And that's something you see here in the tribes of Israel and in their relative numbers and their relative places of importance. Now, before we look at the final section of these chapters, let's just spend a moment with the Levites. I say a moment because we'll come back to them again, of course, in chapter 3. But here the point is made very clearly and simply that the Levites were not to be numbered. Now, they were not to be numbered for the very simple reason that they were to have no inheritance in Canaan. They had no inheritance in the land. They were given cities in the land, as you know, but they had no family or tribal territory at all. This was promised of God and fulfilled by God. And yet, it was to Levi that a particular inheritance was given. It says, I think, four times in the Old Testament that the Lord himself is the inheritance of Levi. Now, what was it that caused Levi both to lose inheritance and to gain a new one? Well, you would need to go back to the book of Genesis, to the story of Dinah, and to what Simeon and Levi did to those who abused their sister, to their cold act of revenge. And you know, it says also a word concerning this in the blessings Jacob pronounced upon his sons on his deathbed, that Simeon and Levi were cruel. Because of this, they had no inheritance. Because of this, Levi had no inheritance. But then the second question, why then were they given a special inheritance? Well, I think the reason for that is also simple. I think the reason is found in the book of Exodus, where the people of God all turn against Moses. But firstly, the tribe of Levi repents of the rebellion. And then the tribe of Levi, by repenting and turning back to Moses, draw a remnant back to Moses. Exodus chapter 32. And I think that is why this tribe is given a special inheritance. And their inheritance is the Lord himself. And they are to be temple servants. It is telling that God took this repentant tribe and set them aside so that he himself should be their portion. You see the way God is acting in setting aside this particular tribe? And do you see the way God still acts in setting people aside to serve him in particular ways? Doesn't the New Testament teach us that God does exactly the same when he chooses people to have different places and different functions within the church of Jesus? Doesn't he do that in Ephesians chapter 4? And is this not a mark of the true church of Christ? That God continues to call people out to serve him. If we go on from here and through the years, God does not call anyone for service, then I, for one, am going to have questions to ask myself. I would want to know if God is really in the midst of us, if men and women are not being called to particular service. I would want to know if we are really heeding God's voice, if no one is hearing the call of God. Because God's voice is heard when his living word is preached. I believe also that God's voice is heard when the preacher has a heart and soul yielded to God, of course. But it's the word itself that contains the call of God. And when the people of God are open to him and spiritually awake and expecting God to speak, then God will call individuals to special service. Are you expecting that? I am. Later on, when we find Levi being numbered for a separate purpose, for a different reason, we find that they are insignificant in numbers. There's only 22,000 of them. They are less than half of most of the tribes. But you see, the strength of the Levites was in their separation to God, not in their numbers. The importance of the Levites was in their separation to God. And therefore they did not live around a tribal ensign, but they lived around the sanctuary of God. Now, you'll think we're going to spend the same time we've just spent in chapter 1 and chapter 2. Fear not, we're just going to rattle through it. Chapter 2 is concerned with formation. We said it was concerned with place. Do you remember? Each group of tribes, four groups of three, was to encamp around the standard of that group, the ensign of their ancestral house. If you're interested, then Jewish tradition says that Judah's group gathered around the lion. Reuben's group gathered around the sign of the head of a man. Ephraim's group gathered around the sign of the ox, and Dan around the sign of the eagle. And I'm sure you know very well that these are traditional symbols of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke and John, found right through into our own Celtic traditions in the Book of Kells. The significance of that you can think of for yourself. Now, debate still goes backwards and forwards as to whether the formation of God's people here in chapter 2 was one for battle or one for travel. Now, I think it is both. I think it is a pilgrimage formation and a fighting formation. I believe that they were to journey in battle formation and that they were to battle in their traveling formation. I believe it is both. And I believe that Israel traveled in battle order because she was God's instrument of judgment upon the Canaanite nations, whose wickedness was now finally ripe for judgment. And even the Levites at the center were part of this holy warfare. Don't we need to be reminded that the Christian life is both a journey and a battle, and that we are to travel in battle formation, and we are to fight in our pilgrimage order? Don't we need to learn that? Don't we need to learn that we have a place in this pilgrimage and amongst the people of God, and that we have a place in the battle? Now, sometimes, like all soldiers, we begin to wonder who's giving the orders and whether the orders are being properly obeyed. Like all soldiers in battle, there are times of confusion. And like all pilgrims, I suppose, there are times when we will wonder if we've wandered and lost the way, and we can wander. But given these times of confusion, and given these times when we wonder if we are lost, there is still a strategy to it all. We travel in battle order. We battle in our travel order. There is a unity at the heart of everything in God's purposes, and we have a shared purpose in God. Let me close by giving you a picture of things in chapter 2. The people of God march forward with a group at the front, a group at the back of three tribes, of course, a group out on this flank, a group out on that flank. To the east, to the front, which is another reason why all traditional Hebrew maps have east at the top and not north, but to the east at the front is the biggest group of 186,500 men. Judah leads. Judah nearly always led. The lion tribe, from whom Christ would come. Judah leads, with Issachar and Zebulun. Out on the north wing, there's Dan, with Asher and Naphtali, less men, 157 or so thousand. Out on the south wing, the other side, there's almost the same number, 151,000, with Reuben and Simeon and Gad. And behind is the smallest group, just over 108,000, with Ephraim and Manasseh and Benjamin right at the back. Now, in the middle of this traveling group of four small armies, there's Moses and Aaron. And out on their right, part of the family of the Levites, the Merarites. Out on their left, another part of the family of the Levites, the Kohathites. And the Gershonites, the third group behind. But there's something else right at the middle of this group in the middle. And it's the tabernacle. And there's something at the heart of the tabernacle. And it is the Ark of the Covenant. Every single Israelite knew his place, by tribe and group and family and household and individual. God had a place for everyone. Judah in front, Benjamin behind, but God at the heart of it all. God at the center. Now, it's not hard for you to see that this is a picture of you and I in the Church of Jesus Christ. We are a pilgrim people gone to war. We are marching in battle order for Christ, each in his or her place, or at least we should be. And the power of it all is found at the center of things, with God our Savior worshipped and adored at the heart of his people. Now, is that what we are like in the West Kirk? Is that what we want to be like? Is that what we are going to be like? Each in his place, and God at the heart of things. God's presence in worship, God's presence as his word is preached, at the heart of it all. The message of these chapters is found in this. That God and his word are to be at the heart of his people. You know, this people, a travelling rag, tag and bobtail, this people put terror in the hearts of the nations. Why? Because God was at the heart of them. Because the tabernacle and the ark of the covenant were at the center of all things. And that's the way God still marches out with his people. He goes at the heart of them. Do you know what caused Israel to fail? You say disobedience. Yes. Disobedience and absenteeism. A refusal to march in order. To be and to stay in place. To be faithful and loyal and true. That's what brought failure to Israel. She was meant to march out as a pilgrim people ready for battle, with God at the center.